Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Nicholas Fuentes is the head of the America First movement. He is a self-declared racist, anti-Semitic, misogynistic, white nationalist. He has a popular online show and a podcast. He has a political action conference that has counted elected members of the Republican Party as speakers and attendees. He has been subpoenaed by the Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the United States Congress, in which he participated.
And we're going to get Donald Trump in office for four more years so that he can take every last illegal alien and throw them back over the border.
That's another red pill. The sixth, I don't know if I should say this for legal reasons, but I'm going to anyway. The sixth was awesome.
Bruh.
It was awesome.
Love.
And you want to know why? It's because that was the perfect end to the Trump administration. Like, how could it have ended any other way?
Last month, at his third America First political action conference, just before introducing Georgia Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to the podium, Fuentes proclaimed his admiration for a different authoritarian.
To borrow a phrase from a friend of mine, our secret sauce here, it's these young white men. Yeah! That's what we call the secret ingredient. America and the world has forgotten about them, but not us. You know, they say about America, they say, diversity is our strength, you know? And I look at China and I look at Russia. Who, can we give a round of applause for Russia? Yes. Absolutely, absolutely.
That was on February 25th. Russian President Vladimir Putin had launched his attack on Ukraine just 24 hours earlier. On March 16th, Nick Fuentes said this.
We continue to support Tsar Putin in the war effort. We want to just keep in mind, we want to keep our brave soldiers in the white, blue, and red in our prayers and in our thoughts as they continue to liberate Ukraine from the great Satan and from the evil empire in the world, which is the United States. So, of course, our thoughts and prayers, our hearts go out to you, the pride of the Tsar, the pride of Moscow.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. America first or Russia first? Nick Fuentes may be the extreme fringe of the extreme far right. And it should be underscored that both dissent and most speech are protected in this democracy. And it must remain that way. And yet, at the same time, Fuentes is a part of a wider disinformation and propaganda loop between Russia and the American far right. They are in a tight embrace. Why? And what impact could that have on the United States itself? That's what we're going to take a look at today. And joining me now is Jason Blazekas. He's a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center, a nonprofit research center, and a director of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism. And he's with us from Monterey, California. Jason, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on the program today, Meghna.
Also with us is Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Jason.
So first of all, Jason, let's just stick with Nick Fuentes here for a second and sort of analyzing what this embrace or this disinformation loop between the far right in the United States and Russia looks like. Tell us a little bit more about who Fuentes is and what he's been saying recently about his admiration for Putin.
So Nick Fuentes is absolutely part of this disinformation cycle that starts with a topic in content. And Nick Fuentes is pushing content in many ways on behalf of the Russian Federation and Vladimir Putin. He is effectively a distributor of propaganda, and that propaganda is hitting audiences. And this is the key part of this. Audiences in the United States who the Russians would like to see more sympathetic and on side with the Russian narrative regarding what's happening in Ukraine. So it's part of this cycle. And Nick Fuentes is attracted, I think, to Vladimir Putin for a few reasons. I think the idea that there is a strong man, an authoritarian figure, who is pushing an anti-elitist, anti-globalist agenda speaks to Nick Fuentes and the individuals that populate the America First Political Action Committee, where you had a clip on the beginning where he was speaking about the importance of Tsar Putin. The other aspect of this is, I think, quite frankly, is this idea of Christian nationalism that Vladimir Putin has been pushing forward. This appeals to people like Nick Fuentes. It appeals to people that Nick Fuentes has hosted at AFPAC, like Marjorie Taylor Greene. The fact that this is an initiative in many ways in which Russia is trying for quite some time to whiten Russia, and this appeals to a white supremacist like Nick Fuentes. And then finally, there's this pushback within the Russian Federation against liberal values as well. Russia eschews ideas like embracing the LGBTQ plus community, and that's something that also appeals to Nick Fuentes. And this is why I think he's so critically important to the Russian Federation, because he does have a big following in the United States that dates back to the discord we had in the United States regarding the election.
Right. So we're going to talk. I want to ask you in a second, Jason, about sort of who the following is in the United States. But just to sort of draw some more connections here, in that America First Political Action Conference that Fuentes has hosted, notably and purposefully right opposite of CPAC, right? The regular conservative political action conference that happens every year. But in Fuentes' conference, we've had attendees such as Marjorie Taylor Greene that we talked about. Representative Paul Gosar has attended. I note that this year, last year, we also had Joe Arpaio, the former Arizona sheriff. We have had, in terms of people coming out of this movement in 2021, the Republican gubernatorial candidate Don Huffines in Texas, hired a staffer directly out of the America First Fuentes' movement. And let me also add this, that this year, that AFPAC conference heard from Arizona State Rep. Wendy Rogers. And I want to play a moment here because you talked about the Christian nationalism, Jason. So here's what Wendy Rogers said, praising Nick Fuentes and his followers. She said, "I truly respect Nick because he's the most persecuted man in America.
And I so appreciate how you never give up. We need more strong Americans like you who never back down. We must always put our shoulder to the wheel to move the Overton window toward Christ, America First, freedom, and our founding documents. Pursue, stay strong. You and your fellow patriots are the future."
That's Arizona State Rep. Wendy Rogers speaking at the America First Political Action Conference. Jason, the reason why I wanted to play that is her note, her talking about the Overton window here. So essentially trying to push the realm of the acceptable further and further to the extreme right. So how does this sort of drawing in and echoing of Russian propaganda fit into that?
So it fits in a number of ways. You know, people like Fuentes obviously is an individual that has a pretty significant following in the United States. A lot of people adhere to his perspective, and his ability to work and have the ear and host politicians who are in the United States Congress allows for him to normalize the messages he's conveying. And from the Russian Federation perspective, that is effective because he's a distributor of propaganda on behalf of the Russian Federation. And for a lot of people who may be listening to Nick Fuentes, aside from the sort of the chants regarding Putin, these other narratives he pushes forward may not necessarily be seen by individuals who are receiving that message as being a Russian message. And I think that's why it's particularly fascinating to watch this and to observe this, because it is a way to give the Russians some level of plausible deniability.
Mm. Now, Jack Beattie, you've been listening here to what Jason has to say. Your quick thoughts.
Well, extreme as this fellow is, what strikes me is how close to the suburbs of real power he's been. For example, I read that he attended the Stop the Steal rally with a VIP badge or label. And I further read that the January 6th committee is looking into a donation of $250,000 in Bitcoin, a Bitcoin donation that was given to him. Where did that come from? And was that used partly to stop the steal, to back the Stop the Steal rally? The point is, that rally was a Trump rally. And was Russian money involved in that? What do you think about that, Jason?
So that's a great question. In the $250,000 equivalent dollars in Bitcoin that Fuentes has received is of interest to the January 6th Select Committee. And that came from, according to analysis by a crypto forensic firm named Chainalysis, from a French national who was deceased at the time and essentially conveyed in his will that funding to Fuentes. And this was a French nationalist with very radical right-wing leanings. And the great question I think the committee wants to examine is how was that money used? And this is another example why Fuentes is an effective purveyor of disinformation, sometimes on behalf of the Kremlin, either knowingly or unwittingly, because he does have that large following and he's very well financed. And that's another reason why he's so dangerous.
Well, so we're talking this hour about this disinformation loop between the American far right and Russia. And we've had 30 seconds before the break, Jason. We're already getting some comments in here because we're gonna expand our analysis in a second to, for example, what Tucker Carlson says. But we've got a listener who says it's not really fair putting Tucker and Nick Fuentes in the same category. Just briefly, what do you think about that?
They're both advocating generally on behalf of Putin. The difference is their audiences and the way that they message. So obviously Tucker Carlson is more perceived to be mainstream than Fuentes. But let's be honest, they both have, for instance, parroted ideas like the Great Replacement Theory, which are absolutely part of the white nationalist and supremacist playbook, the idea that white people are being replaced. So Carlson does that just like Fuentes has.
So when we come back, we'll talk more about this disinformation loop and we'll give some more examples as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at the disinformation loop between the American far right and Russian propaganda, and really asking the question, what impact does that disinformation loop have here on the United States? I'm joined today by Jason Blazekas. He's a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center, a nonprofit research center, and also former director of the Counterterrorism Finance and Designations Office at the State Department. Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, joins us as well. And let's walk through another example of how this disinformation loop, as we're calling it, how it works. Because here's an example. As you may well know, Russia has been pushing theories about American bioweapons programs for many, many years. So that in and of itself is not new. But since the beginning of Russia's attack on Ukraine, that bioweapons story has mutated. For example, here's Tucker Carlson on Fox News on Tuesday night.
Why is the U.S. government funding some kind of biological research in Ukraine? What is it for? We were immediately shouted down. You can't ask that question, but we can because we're American citizens. It's our money. It's being done in our name. And so we would like to know. The Biden administration, of course, didn't answer. We found out from a separate source the obvious, which is some of these are bioweapons, of course.
Carlson didn't provide the evidence from this supposed source. But we should note, though, that lies take flight because they often contain a kernel of truth. And in this case, it is a fact that the United States Department of Defense has a biological threat reduction program that does partner with other countries to reduce and counter the threat of deliberate or accidental spread of the world's most dangerous diseases. Now, according to the State Department, quote, the biological threat reduction program's priorities in Ukraine are to consolidate and secure pathogens and toxins of security concern and to continue to ensure Ukraine can detect and report outbreaks caused by dangerous pathogens. And recently, that partnership took a specific form. Again, according to the State Department, quote, Sanitary Epidemiological Department of the Medical Command of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense has received 4 mobile laboratories from the Defense Department's Biological Threat Reduction Program with the goal of reinforcing the system of epidemiological surveillance in the armed forces of Ukraine, end quote. But those facts have been twisted, again, by that right-wing Russian propaganda loop into a different allegation, as you heard Carlson mention earlier, that the U.S. is funding secret labs in Ukraine to develop biological weapons. Well, the Brookings Institution's Artificial Intelligence and Emerging Technology Initiative has decided to try to tease apart how that story got started and how it spread. Jessica Brandt is policy director there.
The specific theory, we think, first appeared actually in far-right channels, including on Gab, actually ahead of the invasion. It just didn't get much traction at that time. We know that on the day of the invasion, a QAnon supporter boosted it on Twitter. And from there, it really took off in sort of pro-Trump and QAnon circles, including popular websites in that space.
At the beginning of Russia's attack on Ukraine, Moscow repeatedly said it had invaded the country to, quote, denazify Ukraine and protect Ukrainians from their own government. There was no mention of secret bioweapons labs. But when the story popped up here in the United States, Russia picked it up and spread it in the United Nations, on social media, on Russian TV. And then came March 8th.
March 8th was really a turning point. On that day, Victoria Nuland, who's a senior State Department official, testified in front of the Senate.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians.
Tucker Carlson on Fox News, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon and Republican activist Candace Owens and others took that testimony from Nuland and twisted it.
After this testimony, this is when we really started to see it explode across Russian state media on Twitter, Moscow's diplomats on Twitter, and then within right-leaning circles in the United States. You know, that's the day Steve Bannon picked it up on his podcast. And the next day, March 9th, Tucker Carlson does a segment on his show.
Under oath in an open committee hearing, Victoria Nuland just confirmed that the Russian disinformation they've been telling us for days is a lie and a conspiracy theory and crazy and immoral to believe is in fact totally and completely true. Whoa.
Enter China.
And quickly, China piles on. And this is very much for its own interest. You know, Beijing would like to cast aspersions on U.S.-funded labs in order to advance a conspiracy theory that COVID originated in such a lab in order to deflect blame for its own early mishandling of the pandemic.
In recent days, the far right or far right media, I should say, has added a new twist to this theory. The story is now that President Biden's son is involved. Jessica Brandt thinks she knows why Hunter Biden got folded into the conspiracy theory.
This latest effort to layer Hunter Biden into the story is really preparation for the midterms. It's about exploiting partisan divisions and driving them up in order to keep Americans distracted, divided, and unable to push back on Russia in a coherent way.
That was Jessica Brandt, policy director at the Brookings Institution's Artificial Intelligence and Emerging Technology Initiative. Jason Blazekas, what do you hear, what's important to glean from this example of the bioweapon story?
Well, I want to take a step back and just point to 2008 when the Russian Federation invaded Georgia. The press lamented the Russian invasion. The Russians were not coming out good in terms of the propaganda surrounding that invasion. And I think after that, they learned that they needed to control information in a way to change narratives. And this is part of an initiative because the Russians are doing so poorly on the ground in Ukraine that they're breaking out all kinds of different ideas, narratives to push forward into U.S. audiences to create discord. And they're doing that because the United States has played an important role in taking the economic fight to the Russian Federation. And this is really ultimately about changing the narrative. It's about saying that Ukraine's not a democratic country, Zelensky's not democratic. Look at these things between the United States and Ukraine happening that is against UN conventions. The idea that somehow secret biolabs are being used for offensive purposes is about trying to change that narrative. And there is a ready-made office of individuals, of audience of individuals, QAnon believers, those who despise the Bidens that are ready to believe this. And what's most interesting to me about Tucker Carlson is that not only is he amplifying the message that was originally created within the right-wing community and thus amplified by the Russians and affecting U.S. perhaps perceptions of the Ukrainian conflict, but also when Tucker Carlson's doing this, there's another audience that's listening to Tucker Carlson, and that's the Russian audience, where Tucker Carlson has been on the airwaves in Russia. And this program that you had excerpts from are things that the Russian citizens are listening to on Russia state-sponsored TV. And this is what's really interesting to me, is that Tucker Carlson's also being used as a way to create support for Putin's invasion in Russia, as a way to justify the Russian invasion to the Russian population, which, as we know, has been protesting the Russian invasion. And in this context, it really is a two-way street of disinformation, hitting the American audience, trying to create discord, and also the Russian audience as well, trying to build up support for the invasion.
Well, in fact, on March 18th, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was on state-funded television talking about his admiration for Fox News.
We know the manners and the tricks which are being used by the Western countries to manipulate media. We understood long ago that there is no such thing as an independent Western media. If you take the United States, only Fox News is trying to present some alternative point of view.
I should say that's Sergei Lavrov on the Russian TV news network RT. Now, let me turn to Natalia Antilava. She joins us from London. She's editor-in-chief of the online news platform Coda Story, which focuses on disinformation and authoritarian technologies. Also writes a weekly newsletter called Disinfo Matters, and we have the link to that at onpointradio.org. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Agnes. It's great to be here. Hi, Jason and Jack.
So first of all, Natalia, can you tell us a little bit more about pick up where Jason left off about the how this disinformation loops works regarding its impact, for example, on the public in Russia?
Yeah, you know, there are a few things that really stand out. I mean, first of all, I have to say, you know, Jason talked about a pushback against liberal values that's happening in Russia right now. I would describe it as in much stronger terms. It's a full-on war on liberal values that's happening in Russia now. And it's happening most publicly on state-funded TV. There is no other television anymore in Russia since the invasion of Ukraine. All the independent channels have been booted out of the country, shut down. And the Russian television has actually stopped all of its entertainment programming, and it's now gone into full-on propaganda mode. And probably Tucker Carlson is possibly one of the most reasonable, mildest things that you will hear on Russian TV. I'm not exaggerating. You know, I was just listening to one of the recent flagship programs with this that featured this political scientist that gets rolled out a lot on Russian state TV calling for the nuclear war with Europe. you know, screaming, Europe, you need to understand that you will get a nuclear war. There will be a nuclear war, calling for Russia to denazify Poland now. So the argument used for, you know, Ukraine, now applying it to Poland. And what's really important to understand about it, all of it, is that this has been happening on Russian television for years and years, since about 2011, when Putin really upped its rhetoric and really started building his, you know, incredible, on the basis of sort of existing Soviet-era propaganda kind of in disinformation experience, he started building this incredible disinformation machine that is now, you know, working, churning out so many narratives. And I think the loop that we're talking about here, you know, it's more of a narrative loop rather than necessarily disinformation loop. I mean, some of it is definitely lies, but some of it is, it's the narratives. I'm so struck to hear Wendy Rogers say Overton Window, because, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners know about Overton Windows, but I learned that Overton Windows were, you know, this kind of a term to describe the realm of acceptable can be pushed further and further. I learned the term when I was covering the war in Ukraine in 2014 during the first Russian invasion that followed the annexation of Crimea. And everyone in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, where the separatist movement was turning, you know, very much fueled by the hatred that was happening on Russian television, it was turning into a real war. You know, it was kind of, the hatred was spilling out, the propaganda was spilling out and turning into real violence. Everyone I spoke to a year later, after the war began, would talk to me about Overton Windows. You know, from young students to pensioners to everyone who was watching Russian TV talked about Overton Windows.
Yeah.
You know, now they reach the United States. Incredible.
Yeah. And Jack Beattie, you've been listening carefully here. Your thoughts on sort of how this works both in Russia and in the United States. And Natalia's point about a narrative loop, perhaps more, being more important to understand it that way versus as a disinformation loop.
Yeah, I think she's onto something. And we have our own Overton window here as regards the January 6th insurrection. Remember, it began with, oh, my God, the Republicans were Mitch McConnell. This is terrible. Kevin McCarthy, a dark moment. Well, within 6 weeks, that began to shift. And now, officially, the Republican Party refers to the insurrectionists as what? Protesters, people bringing out the great American tradition of free speech. So just in that year, a year and a bit, look what's happened with our own acceptance of extremism in a political party. It's gone from being, you know, and we just find this anathema to, oh, it's as American as apple pie.
Natalia, do you want to respond to that?
I'm just fascinated by how this, you know, the narratives travel. And I think, you know, one other thing that is happening, and I think it's important to look at it. I mean, this is exactly why it's important to look at it globally rather than because they, you know, they don't respect these narratives and these lies. They don't respect the borders, right? And tracing them, you know, we've been at CODA, we've been reporting throughout the pandemic on how Russia invested into anti-vaxxer networks. And you can see the anti-vaxxer networks both in Europe and in the United States now sharing the pro-Russian propaganda when it comes to the war in Ukraine, right? So it's a really sort of delicate network, like this carpet weaved of that spreads the narratives.
Yeah. So Jason Blazekas, I appreciate your patience here. We've got about a minute and a half or so before our next break. But I'm curious, again, to just take a look at how these narratives work and evolve in the United States. I mean, oftentimes we'll hear folks like Carlson, et cetera, saying, I'm just asking questions, expressing skepticism of the American government's line, et cetera. And quite frankly, both those things are essential, I would say, to a healthy American democracy. Skepticism, some, you know, reasoned skepticism, and the willingness to ask questions. So it's kind of it's hard and to sort of pinpoint at what point in time does that become, that skepticism then become perhaps a corroding force in the very democracy that it operates in.
I think this is an important conversation, and I hope it continues after we get past the break, because this idea of the narrative is the first step in the disinformation cycle. Picking what could be divisive within a society is so critically important. And at the Soufan Center, where I work, where we've written a number of reports on disinformation, we are tracking a lot of different narratives that absolutely resonate with American audiences. And that's really important because the Russians have identified key narratives that may create even further discord within the American population, particularly as it relates to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And without identifying a good narrative, you're not able to disseminate it and hit it with the audience that you're trying to impact. So these narratives are a crucial component of this conversation.
Well, we will definitely talk more about it after we come back from a quick break. So Jason Blazekas, Jack Beattie, and Natalia Antilava, stand by. We're talking about this disinformation or narrative loop between the American far right and Vladimir Putin's Russia. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Ali Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick look into what we'll be talking about on the show tomorrow. We're going to put our focus out into the deepest reaches of the universe. We'll be talking about the James Webb Space Telescope. It's positioned a million miles away from planet Earth with the hopes that imagery from the Webb Telescope can help us understand the origins of the universe more than 5 billion years ago. And also, what may be happening on exoplanets closer to Earth. So we'll be talking to a couple of scientists working with the Webb Telescope, and we want to know what your questions are for them about exoplanets and the universe's origins. So call us with those questions at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow. Now, today, we are talking about the loop, the narrative or disinformation loop between the American far right and Russia. And I'm joined today by Natalia Antilava and Jason Blazekas and Jack Beattie. Now, let's hear another quick example of this loop in action. Laura Logan was a correspondent on CBS for about 16 years. In 2019, she joined the streaming service Fox Nation. So here she is earlier this month on the streaming platform Real America's Voice. And Logan said that despite what the Biden administration says, she says the Ukrainian military is full of Nazis.
You see dishonesty when it comes to the Azov Battalion, which is funded by the U.S. and NATO. I mean, you can find pictures of them online holding up the NATO flag and the swastika at the same time. Their own emblem contains the Black Sun of the Occult, which was a Nazi SS emblem. And it also contains the sideways, you know, lightning insignia of the SS.
Now, Vladimir Putin first pushed that story, and then, as you heard, Laura Logan picked it up. And then the Russian government amplified her remarks on Twitter. Now, we're even getting comments about this particular story. For example, someone calling themselves Irka Tulip sent us this message saying, after keeping very conspicuously quiet on the United States arming, funding, and training the real Nazis in Ukraine since the early 2000s, On Point is following the corporate lead into crapping on Russia on all fronts. So, Natalia, help us understand this, the Nazis in the Ukrainian military story.
There is a kernel of truth, as you said, and Putin is very, very good at exploiting the truth. He's better at that than telling lies, even. There is a far right wing to the Ukrainian militia. They're a militia, and there are far right supporters, and there are some neo Nazis in Ukraine. Yes, there are also neo Nazis in France and in Germany and in any other European country, many more than in Ukraine, in fact. So, you know, the whole argument comes straight from the Kremlin playbook. And frankly, they exist. It's true. But this is not the main story. Mm. And, you know, you asked about when skepticism, which I agree with you, it's absolutely necessary. When does it become corrosive? And I think it's so important to understand sort of the delivery mechanisms of these narratives, because the US has spent millions on countering Russian disinformation over the years. But because of the way the Russian disinformation works, debunking it really doesn't work. Mm. Because Putin has built a multi-million dollar media networks that include, you know, RT and Sputnik, and also dozens and hundreds, I mean, tens of thousands of tiny websites you've never heard of, and social media channels and Twitter accounts and influencers. And he did it by, and people luck, you know, Lara Logan, and he did it by tapping masterfully into existing fears and legitimate grievances of each audience that they addressed. And we're talking about far right now, but for example, he's also been really good with the very successful Russian narratives are very successful with the far left in the West.
Right.
And the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a gift to Russia, because it just, he turned what should have been a really legitimate debate about the disaster that was caused by the Iraq war, turned into just rounds of exhausting whataboutry, which in turn made him, you know, a kind of a hero for the European far left, at least. So, you know, it's the truth that he exploits that are really dangerous, I think.
Okay, so Jack Beatty, let me turn back to you here, because now we're getting to the heart of things, like this resonance question. I mean, what do you think here in the United States is, you know, really driving or amplifying that resonance?
Well, I think Pat Buchanan, of all people, that paleoconservative, put his finger on it in an essay some years ago. He said the 21st century struggle may be horizontal, with conservatives and traditionalists in every country arrayed against the militant secularists of a multicultural and transnational elite. What we're talking about here, in Moscow is the capital of anti-democracy. The Republican Party is pledged to anti-democracy now. That's what Trump is all about. And it is the capital of anti-liberalism in culture. Indeed, Harold Meyerson calls Moscow what's forming between our right here and Russia. He calls it the intolerant internationale, and this is the thing, that the horizontal struggle where your ally in one country, your right-wing people here are an allied with Russia because they're both defending Christian civilization. This is what's, I think, so dangerous, that this is at a time when the United States is in a proxy war with Russia, and yet our conservatives are giving them memes and handing them narratives and performing Russian propaganda, all in the name of this horizontal struggle. We're conservatives for Christian America, and you're Russia. You're all for Christian world or whatever.
Right. So small L liberalism then being sort of the common enemy between the far right and Moscow. But Jack, I mean, I think you and I were speaking recently about the fact that regarding Ukraine specifically and Russia's attack on Ukraine, there's pretty significant across the board revulsion, right? Whether you're Democrat or Republican for that, there's revulsion for what Russia has done.
Yes, the Pew poll demonstrates that Democrats and Republicans are tied in thinking Russia is a major threat. They're tied on the importance of sanctions, 75%. They're almost in agreement about keeping U.S. troops in Europe. The Republicans are much less enthusiastic about accepting refugees. But basically, there's a consensus. However, GOP voters don't like Putin. But they don't like him at the rate of 78%. They don't like Joe Biden at 95%. Huh. So it skews as soon as it comes to partisanship. And one of the things that Carlson and company do is they take these international questions and they give them that domestic policy valence. So does Vladimir Putin when he denounces wokeness.
Mm. Jason Blazekas, your thoughts?
So in the narratives we're tracking, and to pick up on Natalia and Jack's points, a lot of the narratives we're seeing stoke this idea of fear. And we are living at the tail end, hopefully, of the pandemic. We're watching this event in Ukraine. We really haven't seen something like this in Europe since the Second World War. And the narratives that the Russians are amplifying or creating themselves center on, based on our research at the Soufan Center with our content science colleagues at Limbic, issues related to trafficking, nuclear issues, Nazis in Ukraine. ISIS has been a common narrative related to the flow of foreign fighters potentially to Ukraine, and biolabs. All these things play on our fears. And the one narrative that people might be surprised that's really popular is this idea somehow that Putin's invasion of Ukraine is a pretext to stop child trafficking that global elites are engaged in Ukraine. Kind of this old QAnon conspiracy theory, right, that was so popular over these last few years. And the Russians are amplifying that message because they know that creates within the U.S. population, particularly the QAnon conspiracy theorists, interest in what's going on in Ukraine, and somehow makes Putin look like the new Trump in terms of trying to fight that trafficking that's happening in Ukraine. So it's playing on those fears that's so vitally important, I think, for the Russians.
Okay, so Natalia, let me just step back here for a second, because I also want to just take another moment to understand why Russia is particularly effective at using and amplifying these narratives. I think you had said earlier that Sputnik, the Russian media outlet, is more effective than the Voice of America or the BBC.
That's right. I was recently talking to a media analyst in Lebanon, and he was telling me that Sputnik, the main FM frequency in Lebanon, has been renting airtime out to different stations. honestly, if you ever want to prove that we need public radio, this is one, you know, funded radio. And they've rented it out to the BBC, Voice of America, I believe. It was BBC and Deutsche Welle,
okay,
and also Sputnik. And he was comparing the programming of the BBC and Deutsche Welle. This is all Arab language services of these big companies, and Sputnik. And he said Sputnik just happens to be a lot more engaging, a lot more in tune with like local grievances, with local fears. It's always about the fear, as Jason said, you know, and just understands its audience. Russians are just much, much better at audience targeting and understanding, you know, what it is, what fears and emotions they need to be tapping into. I think the child trafficking is another great example. Russian propaganda loves children. One of the most popular myths on Russian television was throughout last decade has been that the West is trying to legalize pedophilia. And, you know, all of this, we recently noticed that it has been picked up by Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, and he was now repeating it. So in the context of COVID. So, you know, it's fear that they're very good at exploiting, and it's making messages very local and very relevant to the audiences that they're talking to.
Hmm. So Jason Blazekas, let me turn back to you here for a second, because we always get the question I'm about to ask from our listeners when we discuss disinformation and propaganda. And that some listeners ask, well, we're only caring now because it's happening to us, that the United States has used maybe if not exactly the same, but similar tools in previous times, or perhaps even now. Your response to that, and do you think what's happening regarding Russia and the American far right, is it any different than propagandistic tools that for the United States or the West has used before?
So I think there is a very significant difference. If you go back to the time period in which the United States was battling the Soviet Union in the information warfare space, the United States was trying to push forward through dissidents who've defected to the United States or other places in the world like Europe to convey the message of what was happening inside the Soviet Union. What the Soviet Union messaging was predicated on falsehoods. And I think the United States has tried to push through outlets like the Voice of America, sort of what is the world like today through the lens of fact. And I think this is another reason why the Russians are so upset with how the information warfare is going in Ukraine. Mm. Zelensky's got facts on his side, just like the United States had facts on its side against the Soviet Union. And I think that pushes them towards pushing these false narratives. So I don't think there is a moral equivalency between U.S. engagement in the information operation space and the Russian Federation and, of course, the Soviet Union before that.
Understood. So we just have a couple minutes left here. And Jack, I'm going to give you the last word in a second. But Natalia, as we try to sort of walk away with some conclusions or tools here, I heard you say earlier that, you know, the United States is spending millions of dollars to try to dampen the effects of these narrative loops. But at the same time, it's exceedingly difficult because, A, Russia's extremely good at it, and B, perhaps more importantly, the narratives resonate here in the United States and are advanced by widely viewed media outlets, for example, like Fox News. So what is to be done, if anything?
And lots and lots can be done. First of all, protect your democracy. You know, that is the most important thing. There is no comparison between someone like Russia Today and Voice of America, because there is no editorial process at Russia Today. The editorial decisions are made in the Kremlin. It is completely different. And this whataboutism that is understandable, you know, I mean, because the Iraq invasion is a good example. Well, what about the Iraq invasion? Yes, societies need democratic institutions and a debate about big issues. But we also need to remember that leaping into whataboutism is a bit like going to a friend's father's funeral and saying, well, yes, condolences, but what about my father who died 2 years ago? You know, it's not helpful in terms of framing. And finally, I think one other thing to understand is that for Putin, everything is information war. Mm. There is no such thing as media. This show is information war for Putin. So that's how he's framing the world. So, you know, I think the most important thing, when you ask what it is to be done, I think the very simple thing something that everyone can do is pay attention and keep yourself informed with good information. That's a good first step.
Jack, we've got 30 seconds left. I want to give you the last thought on, like, how do we protect democracy from the disinformation loop?
Well, we recognize that democracy has real enemies, and in Russia, but also here. That's the unprecedented thing. You know, the Communist Party in the old days wasn't necessarily an enemy of American democracy. They didn't want to shut down the vote. Big parts of the Republican Party want to do that. That's a real difference.
Well, Jack Beatty, Jason Blazekas, and Natalia Antilava, thank you so much to all of you for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.